Welcome to On the Brink, a fresh lens to take you and your business to new heights. Hi, I'm Andy Simon, and welcome. As you know, our podcast is all about helping you see, feel, and think in new ways about you and your business. And we like to bring together thought leaders and successful CEOs and people who are changing the way businesses are run and about the way they themselves have been transformed by this. And their ideas and tips are all useful for you. I'm absolutely delighted today to have Scott Hunsaker with us. And I was introduced to Scott through the Vistage network that I belong to as well. I'm a speaker, and he's a member of Vistage and a speaker as well. Vistage.com, VistageInternational.com is an organization you should check out. It's a fabulous group of CEOs that's global, and that the whole idea is peer-to-peer helping each other. But for today, Scott is going to talk about teaching your employees to act like and be owners. The challenge, though, and we'll talk a good deal about this, is that 67% of the businesses in the United States are owned by boomers. And our own clients, as well as others I'm sure you know, are all thinking about, what am I going to do to pass on my business and to whom? Is it a family firm that has to think about a son or a daughter? Or is it a not family firm and you have to think about what the succession plan is? Or is there one? And all too often, people don't even pay attention. Scott is going to tell you about his own experiences and then what he learned about making their employees act like and be owners, and you can too. And he'll talk about his 8 steps. Scott, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Annie. Great, really appreciate you having me.
Tell the listeners, so you can give them a better context than I can, about your own development, the different companies that you were in, and that wonderful life that you've had until you've reached the point where now you want to help others do the same.
You know, when you and I were preparing for today, we shared each of our backgrounds, and I actually have a degree in entrepreneurship from Indiana University.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, So, it was a very general background, and I just kept getting attracted to business. I was in banking. I was in the computer industry for a while. One of the things I learned in banking is that the family business gives you about a 10-year head start. You know, the bar is set a whole lot higher, but everybody's watching. So the expectations are really there as well. So I went into the family business, and I've led 8 companies, and I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, my father was a very successful businessman, but he had maybe that 1950s management style. And I saw that as a little bit of a challenge to continue the legacy and the good work he did and does. And so what I kind of found was that my niche was, how do I transfer the institutional knowledge and business savvy to the rest of the team so we could do more, be more successful, and expand and go that direction? And after having done it 8 times, now I work with other business owners. And you mentioned some statistics at the beginning, and I'd like to compliment some of those. You mentioned about the 67% of being owned by baby boomers. Another statistic that makes this even more important today is 54% of business owners are over the age of 50.
Wow. We put those together and we have a huge transformation coming, both of wealth, but also about business, about who they do business with, about how they run business, about how millennials come into business. Man, major transformations coming. Please continue.
Yeah, and kind of follow that line of thought. Here's what I'd like to suggest to the business owners listening to this podcast. When you hang up your business jacket at the end of your career and you look back on your career as a leader or maybe owner, what is going to make you proud? I suspect you have a pretty good mission statement and a pretty good definition of success at the business level, but do you have a mission statement or do you have a definition of success at the personal level? So when you look back on your career, you feel like you've done good work and you're proud of it. When I ask CEOs what their definition of success is, I usually get a couple answers. The first is kind of that knee-jerk reaction, which is money. You know, I get it. We all want to make good business decisions. And the ruler we use in Western civilization is money. I get that totally. You know, how many of your listeners are founding owners?
I bet a lot.
Yeah. And so how important is the legacy?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it isn't just, you know, I built a business. Is there something that follows me in some fashion? A powerful question.
And I'm not trying to be disruptive or picky, but you know, I find people that sometimes maybe give a lot of money away or some like things like that is because they weren't successful in passing the legacy on in their organizations. And there may have been very real reasons to do that. But my point is what's your definition of success? Is your definition of success the employees?
Yes.
You know, some of my employees were my best friends. I've been to their weddings. I've been to their kids' baptisms and those types of things. And so that was critically important to me. And so employees were really important to me, and maybe customers are important. So when a CEO is thinking about their exit plan, there's usually three options. First option would be to sell to a third party. And according to the research, 20% of CEOs say they intend to sell to a third party.
Cash out.
What we found is a very large percentage of them do it. You know, they're usually a manufacturing company where they have a machine that's making a widget and it's going to keep making that widget until the machine breaks or the market changes, which there's a lot of change going on right now.
but they have something, and they have something to sell that somebody else can touch, and it's a cash out.
Yeah. And it's pretty easy to come up with a financial model for that, because if it's a manufacturer, you have a cash flow stream, you apply a multiple, and it's a financial transaction. But if what you sell is, I'll call gray matter or art, you know, and your production machine walks out the door every day at 5 o'clock or in today's world, whatever. How are you going to transfer that? And how are you going to capitalize that? Here's what really got my attention. 80% of business owners say it's their intention to sell to an insider, either a family member or an employee.
Wow.
Only 13% are successful.
Oh my gosh, say that again. 80% want to sell to somebody inside. Yes, go ahead.
It's their intention to sell to an insider, someone that works for the company, either a family member or an employee, but only 13% pull it off.
Wow.
And we've mentioned Vistage a couple times. And, I do believe Vistage can be the best of the best. I've surveyed about 500 Vistage companies. 45% of Vistage companies don't have a plan.
I bet they reflect the others, because Vistage members are very smart. They're very ahead of the curve. My clients who are Vistage members are always in a different place than the rest. So that means that half these companies out there are going to muddle along until they have nothing to muddle along with. That is scary.
And so you have to ask yourself, why? I believe when I work with clients and I talk, I kind of have two messages. One is, let's control the outcome or create multiple paths to success. We can't predict the future, but we can anticipate the future and try and create as many paths to success so we can recognize that. Maybe think about, is there somebody that you know, that your listeners know, that was planning to sell their company in 2008 and 2009? And they're still there today because they're still trying to get that company back to where it was before. And stuff happens.
Yes.
So, we have to have the ability to adjust. And so one of my key things I'd like to talk about is, why is it so important to plan for the future? Because we can't predict it. And so we need to create those things. And the other real key takeaway here is, you can't do this in the last 45 days.
No.
It took me 12 years at my company to transfer that institutional knowledge to the business team. And then we created a culture of ownership where the NFL company risking all their personal financial capital to bet on the future of the company that we had created together. And it's a wonderful experience. There's a lot of trust, and I love strong working relationships. So I got a lot of emotional gratification and fulfillment out of it. And it was working for them and their families as well.
You want to tell our listeners a little bit more about it? Because I'm curious, and I suspect they are as well. What kind of company was it, and how did you begin to make them, those employees, begin to see themselves as owners and then finally become them?
Well, the company name was called Councilman Hunsaker. We designed swimming pools. Now, we didn't design residential swimming pools. We designed commercial swimming pools. So about 30% of our work was university and collegiate. You're up in New York. We did Long Island University, those types of things. We also did about 50% of our work was municipal. So we did a lot of family aquatic centers. When I bought the company, we were licensed in 10 states and we had 10 people. And what I realized is I couldn't grow the company without the team. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad touched every project and it just literally didn't have the ability to get 51 projects because there weren't 8 days in the week. There wasn't enough time.
That's a typical business. That's a small business that stays small.
Yeah. And so what we really looked at is how we were going to transfer that knowledge so we could do it. At our peak, we were doing about 400 projects a year.
Wow.
We were licensed in all 50 states and 3 provinces in Canada. We did the Olympics in Atlanta. We did the peer review on the Olympics in London. We had some work overseas. We were doing some work in Abu Dhabi and those places. But it was a really great experience, and I loved it. And we grew the firm to probably around 40 folks and doing great, great work. And so when I talk about the how of making this a reality, I kind of go through 5 steps about how to do that. And if you're interested, I can share some of the takeaways there and talk about how we did that at Councilman Hunsaker as well as the people I work with today.
Yeah, do it. Because the 5 steps, I think, will give people a sense that they can do it as well. Because I don't think you came up with this the day before you quit. I have a hunch you were beginning to see a transformation going on that you had to build so those 40 people had more than just a job at the end of the day.
Yeah. And so really, when I bought the company from my father, we started day one. Mm. And so the first step is what I call authentic conversations. Now, why are authentic conversations important? If the people you're working with don't have a clear understanding of what's going on, why would they step forward and risk their own assets? I guess you could say they're going to do it on blind trust, but I think that's less and less of our culture today. They want to make informed decisions. So what are some things you can do to have authentic conversations? A corporate dashboard, sharing numbers, employee surveys, customer surveys. One of the things I coach leaders is never go to lunch alone, never go to a meeting alone. This is your opportunity to transfer the art of your business, not just the science of your business, to your team. And I even suggest using that old business tool, SWOT analysis, is maybe a menu of things to talk about. You know, where did we really knock the cover off the ball in the last year? Where did we have misses? Where's our strengths that makes us stand out instead of blend in from others? So you can start sharing not only what they see, but what you see. So you're starting to get on that same page.
But, you know, your point, I'm working with a client now, and they've asked me to work with their millennials. And part of the disconnect is that the millennials sit on one side and the leadership sits on another. It's exactly this kind of building this relationship where you're sharing the visions together. It's a storytelling time. It's a lunch time. It's a more than just simply a transaction. It feels very much from the heart that you matter to us.
I recall millennials are looking for 88% of them are looking for a company that's collaborative.
Yes.
And I think these tools about having authentic conversations is a way of addressing that and allowing you to stand out instead of blend in so you can attract it.
Yes.
You know, I once had a client tell me, Scott, I practice age discrimination. I don't hire anybody under the age of 40. You know, I get it.
Sorry to laugh.
You know, I mean, and there's a lot of that out there. Sometimes we don't say it so bluntly, but there's a real resistance. And one of our other Vistage speakers in the world, Gustavo, talks about that right now, 45% of the workforce is millennials. It's going to be 68%, I think, in 5 years. And in 10 years, it's 88%.
Like it is
and,
us.
You know,
that's right.
Yeah. And so the point is, yeah, you don't have to hire them, but you don't have to be in business either. So we have to figure that out. So authentic conversations is the foundation so we can have knowledgeable conversations. The second step is what I'll call engagement. And I'm going to expand the definition of engagement. And I know it's a little bit of an overused word, but according to Gallup, only 34% of workers in the United States say they are engaged.
That is correct.
Yep. And so, you know, the question is, How do we get people to step up and lead? How do we identify those that have the will and ability to lead in our organizations? You know, on my best day when I owned a business, I would say my success rate at hiring the right person, you know, the old get the right people on the bus and in the right seat stuff, even with all the assessment tools and all the resources I had at my fingertips, I got it right maybe 60, 65% of the time.
And that's a pretty good statistic. Most of the time, if you're half there, you're pretty good. It's hard to find them.
Yeah, I'd rather be lucky than good any day. And I think I had a lot of luck there too as well. But so if we struggle at just finding good people and getting them in the right seat, what makes us think we're going to be any better picking the next leader? So this is something I learned in my banking career when I was at Mark Twain Bank in St. Louis. The CEO there was a guy by the name of Adam Aronson. And his approach was to create a leadership team bench. So he would have about, let's call it 8 to 10 people at any one time, kind of being groomed for leadership positions in the organization. And instead of picking somebody, he allowed kind of the cream to rise to the top for the natural leaders to emerge. Now, how I do that today is I use strategic planning to let those natural leaders emerge. So what does strategic planning do? Well, first of all, it allows you to start thinking strategically about your company instead of tactical. So that's a gift to them about giving them an opportunity to become more involved and more engaged in the organization. But the other thing strategic planning does is it comes with expectations. You know, typically if you use SMART goals, which is a common business tool, you know, they're assignable, they're measurable, they have a due date and all those types of things. And so if people continually demonstrate their ability to manage change, that's a way of identifying the cream rising to the top. And you'll have natural leaders emerge where they're continually pushing the envelope and helping to carry the company forward. That's what happened to Councilman Hunsaker. And that's what happens with my clients as well. If you've never tested your leadership team, it's been my experience that it's not uncommon to have 20 to 30% of them not make it.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're not good people and valuable to your organization. For example, let me give you one of my examples. About 6 months into it, a councilman, one of my engineers came to me and said, Scott, and he was the guy that was kind of the walking library. He knew everything and had been there forever. How could you not have him on the leadership team, right? But he just wasn't comfortable in that role. And after about 6 months, he came to me and he said, Scott, I just want to design pools. Can I go back to my office and do engineering? That's what I love. Of course you can. But if I told him no, he would have had his nose bent out of joint and it wouldn't have been healthy.
But at least he was honest enough with you and you were open enough for him to be authentic in the conversation, coming back saying, hey, that's not me. I don't need to lead. I need to build.
Right. And so, you know, we had an individual that talked a great game but never got it done.
I've been there.
And those types of examples. So after about the first year, we had our solid team and then we could start building on it and start kind of like the structure of a tree and you could start hanging more and more things on it. So that gives you the ability then maybe to go what I call the third step. And the third step is transferring institutional knowledge. You know, my dad once said, he said, Scott, don't write anything down because somebody might take it. and I, you know, that's not uncommon out there today when I talk with people. They're really concerned about protecting their information. General McChrystal, who was our commander in Afghanistan, said, information is not power. Sharing information is power. And the idea is all that information we have in our heads doesn't really have any value until we get it out and share it with the team. And so before you can do that, you got to get set processes and create that institutional knowledge. And so, you know, what are some ways you can do that? Creating a master toolbox, some master processes. If you're a manufacturer, maybe it's Lean and Six Sigma, but if you're a service business or where all your information is gray matter, you need to come up with ways of creating that. Founding owners have tremendous knowledge and, you know, think about what they could pass on to the next generation of leaders. At Councilman Hunsaker, we created something called Joe's Book, which was my father's name. And I asked Dad to write down all the things that kept him up at night during his career. And he would share the science of the tactical issues that caused him heartburn. But he also shared the art of, you know, how do you deal with customers? How do you deal with problems? And probably his biggest gift was that you'll survive. You will come out the other end and it's okay to make it through that journey.
Number four.
So all that information we just put into the company comes with a born on date. So it's only going to have value for a very short period of time. You know, we talked a little earlier, I think, about, you know, there's two ways that a leader can pass along this company. You can say, here's my company. It's perfect. Don't change a thing and don't screw it up. Or you can say, here it is. This is the best I can make it. Use it as a springboard to make it even better. And I trust you to make sound business decisions. Well, that leader that says, here it is, don't screw it up, is missing the point that change is constant.
Yes.
And that product is going to become dated relatively quickly. So we have to teach our new leadership team how to manage change and make informed decisions. So how are we continually sharpening the saw of that institutional knowledge? So we're adapting and adjusting as the market changes, as the employee situation changes, the political situation changes. So we're able to adapt and adjust and create new things. You know, we talk about ways about how you systematize it. For example, if one of your employees comes to you and says, Andy, I got this great idea. And you go, you know, that's the best idea I've ever heard. But 90 days later, nothing's happened.
Yep.
And it happens again and again. What's the likelihood of them bringing you a fourth or fifth idea?
And 80% of the great ideas come from employees, if only they can tell you about them.
Right. So, you know, I would argue if you don't have a way of a systematic way of processing that opportunity for improvement within a relatively short period of time. We use 90 days, but I'm not married to that. That's the key to really energize your employee base about managing change and transferring that institutional knowledge from you to them. When we were setting up our system solution processes at the beginning, I was probably doing 85, 90% of the improvements. The last year or two, I think I might have done one or two. So who owned the institutional knowledge 10 years ago?
Yes,
it was me. And who owns the institutional knowledge today?
All 40 of them. Yep.
Right. And so that was at that point when they realized they had what it took to make solid business decisions. They were willing to step up and kind of push all their chips in on going forward.
And so the fifth step was that they actually became owners of the business.
Right. And so let's talk a little bit about that for a second. And I see this happening in my practice all the time. A lot of times the CEO will say, oh, you know, Andy's been my wingman here for the last 10 years. I trust her. She can finish my sentences. We've been in the trenches together. I got everything. And so I come back and I go, Andy, I'd like to make you an owner. I'd like you to talk about that and those types of things. And you know, I know you can do this. And you go to me, you go, Scott, you know, that's great. And I'm flattered and I'm honored, but you and I are about the same age. And I've been building this cabin out on the shore and I'm thinking about hanging up my shingle here in a little bit.
That's an aha moment.
And so that comes back to the point. If you don't have a written succession plan and a communicated succession plan, I might challenge you if you have a succession plan. Because it takes two people. It's like getting professionally married. It's a relationship. And it's one that has to be developed and cultivated over years, where there's trust, understanding, and a holistic view of where you're going together and how you're getting there. The second way I've seen done it is the CEO would go talk to their lawyer. I said, Andy's my wingman. You know, we've been through all kinds of fires together, and I want to bring her in as an owner in the organization. And they go, yeah, we can do that. No problem. Let me pull some ideas together. And 30 days later, he comes to you with 3 inches of paper. Mm-hmm. And I sit down with Andy, and I said, Andy, you know, we've got this super relationship here. I want to take it to the next level, and I'd like to invite you to be an owner. My lawyer pulled together some thoughts for you, and, you know, you start opening it up, and you start seeing preemptive rights and go along, come along, and estimated taxes and a spousal waiver. I mean, I got to talk to my spouse, and the pucker factor starts going up and up and up, and then we get to the value section, and you go, how'd you come up with this number? And those types of things. And all of a sudden, and I've seen this, is that not only do you not want to be an owner, you think I'm taking you to the cleaners and maybe taking advantage of you.
Yeah, that working relationship has just been challenged.
There you go. So not only did you not build a stronger relationship, you may have lost it.
So let's talk about, though, how to do it well, because assuming we had the authentic conversations, we've engaged them, we put together our leadership team on a bench, and we've been watching them grow, which I've watched in a couple of organizations do really well. We're beginning to transfer institutional knowledge. And then how do we avoid the, oh my gosh, I was moving along just fine, but I don't have anybody to succeed me. You have some thoughts, I'm sure. What works really well?
So instead of those examples I just shared with you that didn't work, and the reason I shared them is because sometimes that's the expectation. So I wanted to raise a little flag. If that's what your listeners are anticipating, here's some ideas about maybe how to approach it differently. And this is what we did. What if we sat down as my team, the group that is going to, the candidates for future ownership, and we started asking ourselves some questions. And the purpose of these questions is to define the expectations of ownership and create a culture of ownership. For example, if I die, can my wife come to a board meeting? Now, there's not a right and a wrong answer there. If the answer is no, we're saying, okay, for you to be an owner, you have to be an employee and engaged in the business. If the answer is yes, we're saying that the business is a cash conduit to support the family way of life. There's not a right and wrong answer, but it's important to know which direction we're heading.
And those are two very different responses.
Yep. Here's another question. If you're a 10% owner, Andy, and I'm a 90% owner, can you prevent me from bringing in another shareholder?
Big question.
You know, if you say yes, then you're saying we're all treated equally. If you say no, then the culture of decision-making is he who has the gold makes the rules.
Yes.
Here's a little nugget. We mentioned millennials a little earlier. I have found in my practice that millennials are more interested in being treated equally. So when I'm in a young organization, the idea that, yeah, I'm a partner. I should be able to decide who my partners are.
Well,
that's the thing. Other questions, about moral things. If you get charged with a serious crime, can you be an owner? If you get convicted, you go to jail. Where do we stop putting our partner first and the company first? And so I start with about 50 questions. That leads to 200 questions. But at the end of that conversation, we have a pretty good understanding about what our combined expectations of ownership is. And every company is different. And typically what I'll do is I'll interview everybody individually because nobody wants to ask a stupid question. They may not know the difference between an S corp and a C corp and that kinds of stuff. So it's some education going on. But then we bring everybody together and we talk about all these conversations. And what I find is about 70% of the topics we're in alignment on. 20% we get there. You know, like let's lose the being charged with a serious crime. Yeah, I guess if I'm in jail, it probably doesn't make sense for me to be an owner or those types of things. And we get there. The last 10%, we may not reach consensus. And then that's where the owner has to make a decision. I'm not willing to go forward unless it's this way. And it may be a little bit of a take it or leave it. But at least now we've had an authentic conversation. So we summarize all those conversations. Then we take that to the lawyer. And our professional team, accountants and insurance agents, all that stuff. And we ask them to develop a company-specific solution that reflects our culture of ownership. So now when we're sitting down with that 3 inches of paper, you understand all that language in there, why it's there and how we got there. Does that build trust?
Scott, though, what you're talking about is a lot of work to prepare for the succession when the elder statesman is going to want to cash out or retire or watch his legacy go. Are they biting into this? I mean, is there enough sense that I made something so powerful and important that it matters to me? Or do you find them running away?
Yes.
Yes, I figured yes.
The statistics we talked at the beginning, about 66% of companies closing their doors and 45% of the companies that you and I kind of work with not having a plan. You know, I think what I see in some of these CEOs is not a lack of willingness to tackle it. It's confusing the urgent with the important.
Agreed.
They're so busy whacking the mole and putting the fires out every day. They're not able to get to the big picture. So what I do in my work is that I try and get them 80% of the way there, do this heavy lifting so they can get that momentum to get it going. And why 80% is because I don't think you can, you know, hire out this is a CEO role, but I can get it 80% of the way there. So you can take it the last 20% and make it your own. So it's not mine. It has to be yours. It has to be your company's for it to really have value and grab hold and become a part of it. The other thing that I would argue, go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, please continue.
Yeah. The other thing that I would suggest is, you know, these steps that I've reviewed aren't just for succession planning. This is good business. This is makes your company more profitable. So let me ask you a question. If you had authentic conversations, you had an engaged leadership team, you had documented your institutional knowledge, you had a system for managing change, would that make your company more valuable to a third party?
Yes. Completely.
Would it make it more sellable? How many of our listeners don't have a company that is able to be bought because there's nothing to be bought. It's all in their heads.
Yep. And all of those people who come to work to make a living, which so many people do, have limited investment in the company for either succession or for transmission to someplace. So that whole process is one of building something more than a bigger purpose around something very important, emotional, beyond the transaction and functionality of coming to work to get a job done. And that's what's so exciting as I'm listening to you, because it's one thing to say we have a mission. It's another thing to live it and feel it and be part of it. And it changes the way you see reality.
My personal mission statement is to find the best possible people, give them the best possible tools, and get the heck out of the way. And so these tools that we've talked about, I think, attract the best of the best. And it's a lot of fun.
Yes, I know.
And if you choose not to sell to a third party, and you mentioned about baby boomers, 64% of baby boomers, I think there are going to be fewer buyers than sellers coming up. So this process also is a way of growing your own owners. So if now you have a, remember we talked at the beginning about creating multiple paths to success. Now you have a company that's worth more to a third party and more viable to a third party. You also have a team that's capable of leading the company without you and even buying the team without you. So it's all about creating choices and paths to success.
And let's go over those scenarios, because we don't really know whether it is better for us, and however you define that, to sell something, but even if it's sold, you want the folks who've been working here to have viable positions in the new company and to add value. Too many mergers or acquisitions fail, A, because the cultures are cockeyed, they don't adhere, or the folks who you've acquired disappear with all that institutional knowledge and find some other place to go with it. So this is more than just simply preparing for a succession. It's really thinking about your value in a bigger way.
Yeah, and remember we talked about the personal mission statement? I find geography impacts that. I find wealth impacts that. I think once people have their family taken care of, they start looking at legacy employees and customers a little more. So maybe the definition of success isn't the highest dollar. It's, you know, it's transferring it and keeping that legacy alive. Because if you sell it to a third party, what happens to the legacy?
And you know, I'm married to a serial entrepreneur, and he just sold his last company. He took it from zero to be the fifth largest in the K-12 assessment space in the U.S. And it was just sold to a very large company. And in the process, we're watching the changes that are going on to what did they buy and how are they holding on to it. And then we stop looking because it's gone. But he's built several companies, and each one, as you know, once it's gone, it's gone. But part of this is a commitment to both the customers and the employees to leave them better off than before. And that requires a very collaborative team effort. It isn't a solo job anymore. You're not playing all by yourself.
Yeah. So when you ask the question about, you know, this takes a lot of work, I would say it's good, sound business practices, no matter what your definition of success is. And even if you're a nonprofit or something like that, I think the first four steps are really a great way of transferring that institutional knowledge to the next leadership team, so that that good work that nonprofits do can continue on. Because a lot of times it's based upon an individual. How are you going to keep that legacy alive of doing that mission?
Do not underestimate the challenges for nonprofits today. Very many of them look like boomer-owned companies. Their audiences and donors are the 55 to plus, the boomers. Their old habits of raising money are old habits of raising money. And I don't care whether it's Eva's Kitchen that I belong to or another organization that we went to work with. They just had a very old model with no succession plan for anything. And quite frankly, the model you expressed here is very valuable for anything that we're running, because at the end of the day, it's all about who comes next, what's the people that we're going to have, and how do we transition to the next generation. You know, I'm looking at our time, and I always hate to end our conversations. I've learned so much. As I'm listening, I know who I'm going to share it with. Scott, you are you're terrific, and I can imagine Vistage loves you. I mean, I've done 325 Vistage talks, and I have enormous, I love my Vistage work. It's crazy, but I love it. The sharing is the power in this. So if people want to get a hold of you so you could share your process with them, tell them a little bit about where they can reach you and the kind of work you like to do.
Sure. The name of my company is called Ardent Group, and the website is ardentgroup.com. My phone number is 314-283-1589. Feel free to drop me a note, and we can certainly chat. There's some materials out there. I'm in the final stages of a book, so hopefully that'll be out and about in the not-too-distant future, where there may be a little bit more of a deep dive into some of the topics we've talked about during our time together today. But I really enjoy working with business owners. I tend to focus on companies between 15 and 150 employees, and helping keep the legacies of these companies alive and doing good work in the future, so we're not kicking them to the curb when the current leadership team leaves.
I've had such a good time this morning. I can't thank you enough for being my guest. I'm so glad you were referred to me. It's so much fun. And for those of you who have been listening, Scott Hunsaker has given us some really important process tips. Have authentic conversations to begin, even if you've just moved into the C-suite, or you're thinking you're a son or daughter in a family firm. It's a good time to start to change the way you engage, which is the second step. And the part of that is developing a leadership team, a bench, as opposed to a solo that may or may not work. Begin to think of this intentionally as if running your business and succeeding in your business and passing it along are all the same process. And then don't forget the institutional knowledge. There's a master toolbox. I love that idea, and I love Joe's book. It could be anybody's book, but you got so much knowledge. What's keeping you up at night, and how can you share it? And then what's the passage on to the next stage? Don't let it hit you on the head. I often say if you want to change, have a crisis or create one. You don't really want a crisis now. You want to make it happen so that it happens smoothly and easily with intentionality, and that becomes your legacy. So all of you boomers and those of you inheriting those firms and those of you who are beginning to work for them, there's process here that could help. Thanks for joining On the Brink today, a podcast about a fresh lens to take you and your business to new heights. Don't forget, send me your questions, info@andysimon.com. That's andysimon.com. Every Friday, I have an Ask Andy. I take your questions, turn them into answers, and help you also change. If you're on the brink, don't stop listening. We're here to help. And thanks again. Have a great day.